Plenty on the radio today, from a novel about a young murderer to the condition of graveyards. And do we share the same sense of humour with our English neighbours? This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Creche fees are coming in at €870. Phenomenal money that you're forking out on a monthly basis, Claire.
It is. It's another house plus. That's what it is. You know, there's no two ways about it. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's another mortgage.
To me, the job of the comic is always to find the similarities between things that are different and the differences between things that are apparently similar.
And why aren't the graves being maintained? Is it just the weed? Why can't they find a different herbicide and treat the weed? And it's dangerous. It's upsetting.
And we'll start here on the Ryan Tuberty Show and a dark tale of a young murderer. Nancy Tucker's debut novel is called The First Day of Spring, and Nancy was telling Ryan about its storyline.
So The First Day of Spring tells the story of Chrissy. Chrissy is an 8-year-old girl who lives with her mother, her kind of on and off father, and her mischievous bunch of friends. And the book opens with her mischief escalating to murder when she kills a 2-year-old boy. And her storyline is interspersed with the storyline of Julia, who we learn early on is not in fact a new character, but Chrissy living her life as an adult when she's been released from secure care.
Wonderful. And the story is told, this dark tale is told mostly by this 8-year-old, our central character,
yeah.
Chrissy, who begins the whole book with the sentence, "I killed a little boy today." So you think, crikey, I was wondering whether I was going to make my way through it, because obviously it's going to be difficult. But there's something almost addictive about Chrissy's description of things. And this follows in this series of books that in Ireland it happens quite a lot. Pat McCabe would have written The Butcher Boy, and Roddy Doyle would have written Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, and Ithaca as well by Niall McMonagall, are all these books that are told through the eyes of a child. How do you do that? How do you get inside the mind of the child to bring us that voice?
It's a really interesting question. I think I was quite lucky because a lot of my professional work is with children and young people. I've worked in schools and I've also worked in child and adolescent psychiatry. So I spent quite a lot of time around children and I felt like I'd got quite well attuned to their kind of rhythms and eccentricities. And I think actually I found writing from the perspective of a child quite a gift, because I think it allows you to look at the world in a kind of new way and quite a plain way. Mm. It allows you to state things without kind of loading them with all the things that we as adults would load them with. And it's almost sometimes, I think it's a kind of emperor's new clothes situation, because, you know, Chrissy says things that adults wouldn't say because of concerns about kind of social connotations. She just comes out and says it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it can be humorous, and also I think it can be affecting. So I found it actually a really pleasurable way to write.
And what's so difficult as a reader for this book is the sense that we should from the get-go kind of despise this child.
Mm.
And we should from the get-go societally punish this child. And we should from the beginning other this child. This child has murdered another child. And yet within several pages you find yourself realising, okay, her background is so bleak and so sad, that bile starts to dissipate. And now I'm confused.
Yeah, it does put you in that situation, doesn't it? I'm glad you've had that response, because that's kind of exactly what I wanted. I wanted all the information to be there up front. You know, it was never going to be a whodunit. It was always going to be a whydunit.
Exactly.
And I really wanted to kind of see where we can get to with people's empathy. And the response I've had so far has been actually really quite touching and I think impressive in terms of the levels to which people are prepared to go to empathise with this character. But as you say, it's also really complex. You know, it brings up complex questions in yourself. Should I be feeling empathy towards her? Should I be condemning her?
Precisely. And that's, in fairness to you, Nancy, you've it was masterful how you played me like
Thank
a
you
fish.
So much.
I was the trout on the fly. And
that's what I was going for.
Yeah, well, you got it. You got there. It was that good. Obviously,
thank you so much.
No, really. Obviously, Jamie Bulger came to mind as I was reading it, and because that defined a certain part of a certain generation listening this morning will remember that the shock and the tragedy of that. And I spoke to a man across from me here at one point, Vincent Lamb, who made a short film called Detainment about.
Yes, I watched that.
You saw? Yes, sorry, is that
I
a short film?
Detainment. I did. Yes.
And those boys who played the Bulger killers, again, we're into your character Chrissy, where they're just boys, but they're killers.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting you bring up detainment, because that was very much a kind of inspiration for writing this book.
Right.
I watched it shortly before I started writing this book, and I was so struck by that level of detachment they had and the complete dichotomy between, you know, the content of the interviews, which is horrific, so horrific they couldn't screen it, and the fact that, you know, in moment-to-moment conversation, just little boys, you know, and true in my kind of experience of child and adolescent psychiatry, children are so skilled at that detachment from their problems.
Yeah, but did they put it somewhere?
Yeah, they absolutely do. And I think what you find a lot of the time is that if you're with a child who has maybe a kind of psychiatric condition, you might have 70-80% of the day when you would interact with them just as any other child. And then 20-30% will be incredible distress. And, you know, incredible aggression, anger, it will all come out. And because it's so concentrated, it comes out in a kind of very intense way.
And the Mary Bell case was also influential for Nancy.
Mary Bell was a famous case, wasn't she, in the UK?
Yeah.
What age was she when she strangled a four-year-old?
I think she was 11.
11 years old. So you probably had a little look at her case just to try and, again, get inside the mind.
Yeah, those are the two cases that were kind of at the forefront of my mind when I was writing Mary Bell and the Bulger Killers.
Mm.
I think it was a difficult question for me was what age to make Chrissy. And she's a bit younger than both of those cases. And I think that for me, it was really important that an aspect of it was that she didn't fully understand what she was doing. That's quite central to the book, I think, her sort of loose grasp on what death really is.
What a clever construct that was about death and her concept of death and whether you could come back from it. And you have to read the book to understand that, I suppose, but because I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, sure.
And you could also, I mean, for you, in fairness to you, my thoughts of the Bulger case and so on, it came and went. In other words, it wasn't like you were transposing one set of facts into a piece of work of fiction.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad about that. It's always tricky, I think, when you do have real life cases that are, you know, in part your inspiration. You're treading quite a fine line between how much do I go with those cases and how much do I use my imagination and think for myself about what has happened. And I think it was helpful that for me, Chrissy felt like such a vivid character in my mind. It felt quite easy to kind of to go with her and see how she was guiding me.
Yes.
And that allowed me, I think, to take a different path from those real life cases.
You did another excellent thing in your book, which was you, and this is very, very few people get this in adulthood, is to understand how irritating adults are towards children. No, but really, adults don't understand children.
Yes, I'm so glad, yes. Yeah. And well, this is something I remember intensely from being a child.
Yes.
I remember thinking, God, adults are awful. And they're a kind of lump. They're just a homogenous mass. You don't really see them as individuals. You see them as just like, I think Chrissy describes them as just like a lump of women wearing cardigans. And I remember that so clearly from being 8 years old.
Right. And just to keep going on this point, the fact that, you know, I always think adults treat children like they are either hard of hearing or foreign, or simply a nuisance. And when adults gather in the kitchen, for example, and just add booze, or if it's a pot of tea, they think that suddenly those thin walls have grown thick like a castle. And they can't be heard or seen or, you know, I mean, I think Chrissy spots this and points it out at 8 years old going, they think I'm not here. They think I can't see this.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is what I kind of mean with the Emperor's New Clothes, because I think there are so many observations like this that we would make as adults if we felt we were allowed to. And Chrissy kind of gives voice to them. And I think that's where a lot of the humour in the book comes from. I think when when you're talking about the book in a potted way, it's easy to make it seem like it will just be dark. I think there is, you know, I tried to inject humour where it felt like there would be humour. And I think a lot of the humour does come from those observations that Chrissy makes. And I think there are observations that a lot of us have thought. You know, I think we've all probably looked at kind of excessive public displays of grieving and thought, I think you're quite enjoying this. But, you know, we wouldn't say that, but Chrissy would.
Yes.
Because she's blessed with, A, being a young child, and also just not caring, you know. She's even less restricted by social convention than other children because she's not been taught social convention, because she's not been looked after properly.
And Nancy spoke about her background in experimental psychology.
Experimental psychology, Your guess is as good as mine. I think it's basically a psychology degree. As far as I can tell, it's the same as any other psychology degree.
Okay.
I suppose it might be slightly more research based, but I think it's just the university wanting to be a bit different.
And did that? That's a perfect answer for a ridiculous question. But you did have to deal with children who have done terrible things.
Yeah. So that was in my professional work.
Yes.
Working in child and adolescent psychiatry. I've never worked in a forensic service, so I haven't worked with children who've done the kind of things that Chrissy has done.
Okay.
But certainly children who've displayed really difficult behaviour and have done things that, you know, we as society would say that's not a good thing to do. And I think that's very much, I feel like that sort of underscores the whole book, that professional experience. And also I think it's very relevant kind of to touch briefly on my personal experience, which is of eating disorders, mm-hmm. which was a kind of theme for me throughout my adolescence. I feel like those two things, the kind of eating disorder experience, made me feel I can talk authentically about hunger and how it affects you.
Yeah, and just to
and
fill people...
Adolescent
Sorry, Nancy, to cut across, but just because you had a very profound and serious eating disorder from the ages of, I think it was 11 to 18, you were hospitalised, your mother used to phone to say, is she alive? I mean, this is how bad it was. So you are coming from a very sincere and authentic experience.
I think it just gives you that understanding of true hunger that a lot of people have never experienced, thank goodness. And it is really difficult to understand it if you've never experienced it. You know, there are definitely important differences between my experience and Chrissy's. Chrissy's experience of hunger went from right when she was a baby, and also it wasn't inflicted by herself. It wasn't controllable. So I think that does make it quite different. But the physical feeling of hunger, I think, is quite similar in all cases. And it's a form of madness. It really is.
Do you think so?
I think so, absolutely. I think it changes you in ways that you couldn't anticipate. Just kind of thinking about it or reading about it, it really alters you when you're in that state. It strips you of everything, of every kind of positive quality. It strips you of the ability to be compassionate. Mm. It strips you of the ability to think about other people. It's what we see so strongly in Chrissy. And, you know, I think I remember feeling that in myself. I remember feeling like I don't really understand who I am anymore. And so much of that is just a physical experience of hunger.
Chrissy grows up, she goes into sort of witness protection type of thing, at least, you know, for want of a better expression, and she becomes Julia. And this is the grown-up section of the book where she's now reflecting on life as an adult in her 20s or thereabouts. Now, here's a question. I was off on holidays for a week or two, and I was bouncing around radio stations. I was driving around the country, and I think I came across three or four different discussions on stations all around the place, all talking about essentially transgenerational trauma. This idea that, I know weirdly, it just seemed to be a theme of that week, saying that people who have, adults who have a peculiar behaviour or a destructive behaviour or a self-damaging behaviour can all essentially point to their childhood and say, it wasn't me, it was that trauma.
Sure.
And you with a kind of psychiatric background and psychological background, do you buy that, or do you think it's a get out of jail free card for a lot of people?
It's really interesting, and it's not something I can claim to know an awful lot about. So I suppose I'd be wary of overstepping myself what I would say. I think it's a really good question. I think if we look at Chrissy, you know, we can trace a huge amount to what was going on at home. And, you know, if we look at Chrissy's mum, we can probably trace a huge amount of what was going on with Chrissy's mum to what was going on when she was growing up.
So the cycle continues.
Absolutely. But then what's interesting in the book is that, without giving too much away, I think we look at the way that Julia is with Molly, and we have Molly, who is her daughter, and we have to ask questions about, is there a point when that cycle gets broken?
Yes.
And, you know, on whose shoulders does that fall?
The book is called The First Day of Spring. Nancy Tucker from The Ryan Tubridy Show. And in the morning, Anya Lawler was looking at the hearing for Britney Spears' conservatorship in Los Angeles.
Now, she is and has been for decades one of the most famous pop stars in the world. But Britney Spears has been speaking before a judge in Los Angeles, California, arguing passionately against the control she says her father has over her life under a court-ordered conservatorship. Free Britney protested, gathered outside the courtroom, while inside by video link, Ms. Spears argued against the controls over her life for the past 13 years and the pressure that she's endured.
What do we want? Free Britney!
When do we want it?
Now!
I will be honest with you, I haven't been back to court in a long time because I don't think I was heard on any level when I came to court the last time. I brought four sheets of paper in my hands and wrote in length what I had been through the last 4 months before I came there. The people who did that to me should not be able to walk away so easily. I'll recap. I was on tour in 2018, I was forced to do. My management said, if I don't do this tour, I will have to find an attorney.
Ms. Spears, I hate to interrupt you, but my court reporter is taking down what you're saying.
Okay.
And so you have to speak a little more slowly.
Of course, yes. Okay,
and
I apologize, great.
Of everything you're saying.
Okay.
Sure.
Recap, I was on tour in 2018. I was forced to do. My management said, if I don't do this tour, I will have to find an attorney. And by contract, my own management could sue me if I didn't follow through with the tour. He handed me a sheet of paper as I got off the stage in Vegas and said I had to sign it. It was very threatening and scary. And with the conservatorship, I couldn't even get my own attorney. So out of fear, I went ahead and I did the tour. When I came off that tour, a new show in Las Vegas was supposed to take place. I started rehearsing early, but it was hard because I'd been doing Vegas for 4 years and I needed a break in between. But no, I was told this is the timeline and this is how it's going
to
go.
Then Anya spoke to Suzanne Keane, the editor of RTE Entertainment, about hearing Britney's voice in all of this.
She told the world she was happy, but she's not. She confirmed last night she's lonely. She doesn't want to live this life. She wants her life back, that she's worked so hard throughout her life. And she feels she hasn't done anything wrong to deserve what is happening to her now. So it was absolutely bombshell stuff that came out of the courthouse yesterday.
What was her demeanour in the video link, from judging from the audio?
I think she sounded very put together. It sounded like a prepared statement that she had put together. But I think it was a surprise to hear how coherent she was and how well she spoke and how passionate she was. And it was, you could also hear the sadness in her voice that she's living this life that she absolutely doesn't want to live, that she feels trapped and that she really, really does feel alone and that there's nobody standing up for her.
So that's Britney Spears' side of the story. Who else will give evidence to the court?
Well, Jamie Spears is her father and he has been overseeing her life or her financial affairs and her personal life for the past 13 years. So as part of her testimony last night, Britney actually said, you know, she feels the people who've been in charge of this conservatorship should be in jail. But it really, what happens now, it'll be, according to law in the US, it'll be a team of medical advisors who decide whether she should be allowed free from this conservatorship. Britney is asking that she's not evaluated again medically because she feels she's given so much. She's done so much therapy. She's going three times a week to therapy. She's been evaluated. She's been on retreat. She's been in rehab. And she does not want to be re-evaluated again. So it's the judge now who has to decide. She has petitioned the court, Britney, to be freed from it. And it is the judge now who decides what happens going forward.
And do we know when that decision will be or likely to be?
There is another court date scheduled for July 14th. But the talk is we'll have to wait and see at this stage. We don't know exactly whether it will be decided on that date or it will be further down the line.
Suzanne Keane for Morning Ireland with Anya Lawler. And from Today with Claire Byrne, the rising costs of childcare. Consumer journalist Siobhan Maguire was looking at the issue in the morning.
Now, you've been in touch with parents to get an idea, as I say, of the fees that they're trying to meet. And what did you find? What did they tell you?
Well, I mean, it's staggering for a start, Claire. An awful lot of stress, worry and frustration. And I'll go straight into some of the numbers for you. The majority of respondents came from Dublin. I was hoping for a really good snapshot nationwide. So we did get quite a lot of figures outside of Dublin as well. But in Rathfarnham, for example, 1,100 a month for one child in creche fees. Mm-hmm. In Clontarf, the creche fee for a 13-month-old is 1,080, and this includes all the food for the infant. In Dublin 9, fees to mind a 12-month-old boy for 4 days a week come in at €800. And in Dublin 6, creche fees are coming in at €870 minus a government subsidy. Phenomenal money that you're forking out on a monthly basis, Claire.
It is. It's another house plus. That's what it is. You know, there's no two ways about it. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's another mortgage. And When I was speaking to people, initially it was via Twitter messages, then it progressed to emails, then it progressed to phone calls, then I was added into to various mum WhatsApp groups. It's just a conversation that grew legs and has kept going over the last 2 weeks because women mostly are so frustrated. They feel they're being punished for if they want to go back to work full time after having a baby.
Well, it leads to people having to make very serious decisions about their careers. And I have found in my own circle of friends and with colleagues, etc., that it is when the second child comes along that you really have to make that crunch decision, because basically you get that number that you've just outlined there and you double it. You might get a discount for two children, but essentially you're doubling it.
Absolutely. And we hear so much when government figures come out, Claire, about, oh gosh, you know, people in Dublin are paying through the nose. Well, from figures collated around the country from people who got in touch with me, I mean, you know, these are not affordable prices. And I'll just give you some examples. In Limerick, one lady told me she's paying around £1,100 per month for an 18-month-old and a child in the morning creche. In Selbridge, in Kildare, the monthly fee for a one-year-old is £1,325. In Mullingar, a couple are paying £800 a month for 5 days of care. And one lady who lives in a rural location, she said that she has no options because her local creche only cater for kids over three, which means she either has to work part-time and pay for a minder, which would cost €150 a week, or just stay put.
Mm-hmm. And there are some factors where parents can keep the costs down, Siobhan, but that relies on flexibility in their own working week. So again, it has significant impacts.
Absolutely, yeah. Flexibility is the key. So some of the cheapest fees flagged for me came from a lady in Carrickmacross in Monaghan, and she has two young children in creche, and she is using a sessional rate, which is slightly cheaper. So it's €19 is what she pays, which works out at £190 for a full week for two children. But she herself said to me, Claire, that it's only because she can be very flexible in her work.
With her working hours.
Yeah.
And there's the added stress then for the new parents who are trying to get a child enrolled in the creche. And thinking particularly in urban areas and cities, that's a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah. One woman had her baby 12 weeks ago, Claire, and she's already paying a creche in the hope that that place will be secured when she's ready to go back to work full time.
She's paying for it before the baby
uses it. She's paid a deposit, okay, and she has offered to pay the creche on a monthly basis just to make sure that place is there for her. Mm-hmm. Another lady in Dublin 12 who got into a community creche did something similar. She emailed the creche when she was 6 weeks pregnant, was told that she still had no guarantee that she would get a place. She eventually secured that place, and she started paying 3 months before she needed to put her child into the creche. Now that's €2,400 for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
It's extraordinary, but it is a stress. And I know people who are pregnant who have that worry always in the back of their minds. What am I going to do when I have to go back to work? And they're seeking out solutions when they should be taking it easy and thinking about other things.
Siobhan Maguire, consumer journalist from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, the situation for communions and confirmations this year.
Now, the HSE has urged bishops in the Midwest region to defer first communions and confirmations due to concerns about a spike in cases of COVID-19 in that region. In its letter to bishops, the HSE asked for communions and confirmations to be deferred until September, when most of those eligible should be fully vaccinated against COVID. First communions and confirmations were due to be permitted again from July 5th under the next phase of the government's reopening plan. Let's talk now to Father Brendan Quinlivan, who is Communications Director for the Diocese of Killaloe. Father Quinlivan, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Justin.
This letter, Father, from the HSE, this is an advisory rather than instruction, is that right?
Yes, the letter arrived to the three bishops on Tuesday, and it arose out of some queries that the Department of Public Health in Midwest had received, and also their concern with a spike in COVID-19 infections in the region, and also the rollout of the vaccine programme. And they sent this letter advising the bishops that they would consider deferring First Holy Communion and confirmations until September. Now, many parishes had made arrangements for those ceremonies to take place following the easing of restrictions on July the 5th. But of course, as the news unfolds these days, whatever decision is made in July the 5th may render any of these discussions moot anyway.
How seriously, though, are the bishops taking this advice? Are they minded to postpone these services until the autumn, as they're being asked to do?
Well, they sought clarification about whether it was a recommendation or an instruction from the Department of Health, and the clarification they received was that it was a recommendation. So they then circulated the letter to all of the parishes. They asked them, particularly the parishes that maybe had scheduled these ceremonies for during the summer months, to consult with schools and parents and to see. It is a case that one size does not fit all. The ceremonies themselves, I guess, are not probably the issue, but maybe the gatherings that take place afterwards, it has been said to us time and again. So we are being asked over these days to consult with parents in parishes where these ceremonies have been scheduled and see if they are prepared, acknowledging the recommendations of the HSE, if they are prepared to go ahead observing the existing restrictions.
Okay, but the public health experts no doubt wouldn't have issued this advice if they didn't believe that it was a serious situation that was unfolding, particularly with the spread of the Delta variant, which is potentially more serious and certainly more transmissible. Do you not have an obligation then to help out the health service here by not going ahead with communions and confirmations for a couple of months?
Well, I think, Justin, that one of the issues is that we have done so much in terms of sanitization, observing restrictions. Our churches tend to be large buildings, well ventilated, and observing all the precautions. And we're very conscious that so many people who have made plans, whether it's for events like this or other events, would be deeply disappointed again if those were deferred indefinitely. And we are taking cognizance of the advice and the recommendations, and we are asking parents to be particularly cognizant of those, especially with regard to organising gatherings and celebrations after the ceremonies. We've been told again and again that it's not the ceremonies themselves which are well policed and well stewarded and all precautions observed. And we're asking, we have sent out notification and spoken and circulated the parents, asking them to be very mindful of those recommendations and parishes when reaching a decision.
Father Brendan Quinlivan with Justin McCarthy on the News at One. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan was talking about the UEFA decision on not displaying the rainbow colours supporting the LGBTQ plus community in Munich.
But I do want to talk about two fellas who were on the TV last night, and they brought Ireland into probably a slightly different gear, if you like. Damien Duff and Richie Sadler. I don't know if you've heard about it or you saw it, but they combined forces, according to joe.ie this morning, and Common Sense, to rinse UEFA over their rainbow colours stance. Much of the talk around the Euro 2020 clash with Hungary has centred around the fact that UEFA have decided to block moves to light up the Allianz Arena in rainbow colours. Imagine, 2021, it is quite striking. But Hungary has a very complicated relationship with the community we're discussing. And by complicated, I mean they are very oppressive. And the move was intended as a show of solidarity with the LGBTQI plus community during Pride. And UEFA took it as a political move by the city of Munich and was aimed at Hungary itself and a government that has markedly different views on equality and gay rights. So a UEFA statement yesterday declared in part, quoting, "For UEFA, the rainbow is not a political symbol, but a sign of our firm commitment to a more diverse and inclusive society." In response to the UEFA diktat, the German Football Association are said to be handing out 10,000 rainbow flags to supporters attending the game. And UEFA's actions in recent days were discussed in RTE last night by former Ireland internationals Richie Sadler and Damien Duff. I'll start with Richie Sadler, just a little flavour of what he was saying.
UEFA had a choice here. They had a choice. They had the option to stand in solidarity with a community that has been routinely persecuted, marginalised, discriminated against, attacked in locations all over the world. The most recent attack is from the Hungarian Parliament. They had the chance to do that and they didn't. And they've tied themselves up in knots. The statement there saying, on the one hand, the rainbow flag is not political, but the request to use it in the stadium is. They claim to be about certain values. They claim to be about equality and respect and inclusion and openness for all. You can't credibly claim to be for those things if you run scared at the first opportunity of being up against someone who attacks those things, which is what they've done.
Yeah, that's impressive, to say the least. And Damien Duff, of course, got involved. I've met Richie a few times. He's a terrific guy, no doubt about it. I don't know Damien at all, but here's what he had to say.
To say it's political is absolutely nonsense. It was a chance to show support, their support for the LGBT community. That's a global community. That's in Munich. That's in Budapest, Hungary, where recently they played France and there was homophobic chants, homophobic banners in the stadium. So they talk about core values in their statement. Their core values, and not just because of today, because of even my experience with them, it's just money and power. They're the two that jump out to me. They make out they're about diversity and inclusion. Chance today to show that? Absolutely not. They continually let themselves down and you probably see I'm just angry talking about them because they wind you up, they do. And like I said, respect, not many people respect them.
Great stuff. Damien Duff and Richie Sadler with Peter Collins moderating that perfectly. And, you know, the commentary is around the fact that you have two straight white Irish men talking with passion about a community that have been physically and emotionally beaten up down through the years in this country and around the world. And they've just said, on behalf of the debate as it's raging on now, enough. And I think people were quite impressed by that. So, as was I.
On the Ryan Tubridy Show. And on the live line, Jennifer called Katie about the condition of Dean's Grange graveyard when she went to visit her mother's grave.
Yeah, I walked up the main path. If you're familiar with it, you go in the main gate and we have to turn left and walked up to the end of the path. But we have to kind of go off the path to get into where my mother is buried. So as I got to the end of the path, it was very overgrown with weeds. And it was actually impossible to get into where her gravesite is because we have to kind of step over a few graves and it's in the older section of the graveyard. So when you kind of want to get in off the pathway, you have to step over people's graves and walk around. And a lot of them are sunken because they're quite old. But with the weeds, they were like way past my knee level, you know, and I actually couldn't find a pathway in and I couldn't actually access the gravesite.
Yeah, you've sent us, as I say, you sent us some photographs. I mean, certainly some of these, it looks like almost like a jungle. I mean, it's extraordinary. Yeah. As you say, some of them must be almost up to hip height, those weeds.
Yeah.
And it is the time of year, of course. Anyone who's been out and about will know that the growth is at its peak at the moment. Mm-hmm. But is this just one section of the... of the cemetery?
No, if you go in past where like the little kind of gate lodge is, we have to turn left by like where the bathrooms are. So you walk down, but as you're starting to walk down the long path, you could see the weeds were just kind of more prominent there and they were getting higher and higher and just like overtaking every grave possible, any space that it has to grow. It was just grown, overtaking everything.
Okay, and we've tweeted some of the pictures that you sent us. That's to the Liveline Twitter account. Mm-hmm. But is the whole cemetery is not overgrown then? This is more the older.
It's in the older section, And I just took a walk back down when I was going to the car. Behind where the office is, there's like graves there and there's no weeds. The grass was like just manicured. You know, it's all landscaped properly and nothing was out of place. But it just seems like the older section of the graveyard has just been like very neglected and just left to kind of go a bit derelict, you know.
And your mom has been there for a long time, Jennifer?
27 years, yeah. Oh.
And you would, you know, is it for a birthday or an anniversary? Or
it's her birthday next week and then anniversary would be in the middle of July. But like we would go regular, you know, out to the grave and we plant like the seasonal flowers and, you know, top it up with soil. We don't have stones or anything on it. So we, like, take care of it. You know, it's been maintained, like, over the years, you know.
And is this the first time you've seen the place in this state?
In that state, yeah. There has been weeds before where we had contacted the office ourselves, you know, and said, like, is there anything? But, like, around where the grave is, we'd normally, like, put the weed killer on our own grave and around the side so we can get to it. But this is just like walking into a jungle yesterday. Do you know, it was like, which way do I go? I actually had to look to see where the stone was because I I was thinking, Jesus, like, how am I going to get in here, you know?
I'm thinking, like, whatever about yourself, Jennifer, older
it's elderly people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and like to access the grave that we have, there's a lot of sunken graves. On an average normal day, you kind of have to watch your footing because there's stones, there's sunken graves, there's holes, you know. But an elderly person that's out there, they could just go through the weeds and then their toe gets caught in a sunken hole and they end up like falling onto a grave, breaking a limb, a hip, you know, banging their head, you know. And like if they were to fall down, sure, you wouldn't see them with the height of the weeds, you know.
And Jennifer wasn't the only one who was worried about what they saw at Dean's Grange. Here's Teresa.
I was out there on Sunday just gone. I've got an aunt and uncle there, grandparents, great-grandparents. So they're in different sections of the graveyard itself. And to walk in, we would go in the other gate away from the office. So you're looking towards the back of the cemetery into the right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you'd be hard-pushed to find the grave that you're looking for. I was lucky in that our grandparents' grave is covered in stones. But to get to that grave, I had to walk over other graves because the footpaths are cracked and broken. There's headstones covered in ivy, there's sunken graves. It's really shocking that our relatives and our loved ones' final resting place is left in this condition. And don't forget, I just checked the Dean's Grange wiki page before I came on. There's over 150,000 people buried there and there's over 700 children in the Angel's Plot. 750 children. And a lady I'm from Ringsend. We've got a Ringsend Facebook page, Ringsend People at Home and Abroad. And there's a lady there, Betty Power, had said just a while ago that she herself has paid €89 per grave to have them cared for because she can't get out herself. So if the graves aren't being maintained, not just the grasses and the verges, if people have paid previously for perpetual care, what's happening with those agreements? And why aren't the graves being maintained? Is it just a weed? Why can't they find a different herbicide and treat the weed? And it's dangerous. It's upsetting.
There is actually a notice, I believe, placed out in the graveyard at the moment. I think it was put up there last October, if I've got that right.
It's there from last October, and it mentions that they're going to establish a Friends of Dean's Grange group, and there'll be a strong community aspect, and that they will discuss it publicly. But I haven't seen any public consultation or anything in the newspapers or on social media asking people to get involved and help. I mean,
yeah, because
absolutely nothing at all.
Because as Teresa mentioned there, perpetual care, which is this fee you would pay to the council on an ongoing basis to look after your family graves. And it says in this notice that perpetual care in our cemeteries has been discontinued for some time. The council does not have the resources to maintain individual plots. It is now assumed that individual families take responsibility for their own plots. While this may be a source of disappointment to many, it is simply not sustainable or possible for the council to offer this service, it says. And then it goes on, notwithstanding the above, the council is changing the maintenance regimes in general in the cemetery. For many years, the spraying of herbicide was widespread and used as the only maintenance tool. This practice has also been discontinued, and we're currently in the process, as you mentioned there, Jennifer, of putting together a draft plan.
Yeah.
But Katie, can I ask you, in relation to the perpetual care, for people who are already interned in the graveyard and perhaps their families have since passed away, if these people had entered into a contract and paid for perpetual care, then surely those contracts have been broken. I know there's nobody here now for the council to notify, but where does that leave those graves? What happens in 50 or 100 years' time when they're cracked and open, and who's going to maintain them?
And the perpetual care service, I wasn't familiar with it myself, but was that a once-off payment or was there an ongoing payment for that
service? I think it's you pay it every 2 years. There's a certain set fee per grave.
Yeah, well then I presume in many cases those if you say there was some sort of a contract or some understanding, they would run out, I suppose, over the period that over the 1 or 2 years where that payment covered.
But have the council notified anybody of this? I'm sure there are elderly relatives of people who are buried there who would happily continue to pay to have the graves maintained. It's not just the grave itself. We can take care of the grave itself. I mean,
Yeah.
As Jennifer said, you call out and you take care of your loved one's last resting place. You do your flowers and you tidy that up. It's the weeds and the state of the footpaths and the stones around it.
It's trying to access the gravesite. That's
you can't.
What...
Teresa and Jennifer, then Dolores called Katie.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, you're born and raised in Dunleary.
Yes, I was sad to say. Because you'd actually be embarrassed if you go near Jean's Grange. It's total, utter disgrace. My parents are buried and they're in the middle. There's a grave in front of them. And at the time, there was three graves, one after another. And unfortunately, they're in the middle. So in order to get access to them, you actually have to step over or walk across another grave. But unfortunately, I was there last Friday because it was my mother's birthday and I had a container with plants in it. And I was trying to manoeuvre myself over to get to the grave. And I couldn't find where this round was on the graves in front of my mother's. So I actually tumbled and I had to let go the plant container that I had. And luckily, I caught on to a headstone, which saved me going straight down on my face. I actually got a terrible fright. And plus the fact that I had osteoporosis and I can't afford to take that kind of a fall. But I was just so sad and disappointed to see so many people's graves just been turned into for lack of care from the council. And I just think it's totally unacceptable in this day and age that they can't take some kind of control over the situation.
What do we think, though, that the idea that they're no longer, they now have a policy of not using weed killer? And I think, you know, we know if you look anywhere around, you know, roundabouts or, this, you know, parts of parks and that, there is definitely a drive towards, for biodiversity reasons, for good reasons, not spraying weed killer and, you know, encouraging natural growth of flowers and wild, you know, rewilding patches of grass. Is that...
Yes, I don't have a problem with that at all, actually. But what I do have a problem is with this particular weed. It's of no value to insects or wildlife. It's just a very aggressive and very hard to control weed that continues to grow up high. And it is so strong, to even try to walk through it is quite difficult. And I feel like if they can't spray it, can they not dig it out? I mean, surely in this day and age, there is alternatives to being able to control that kind of aggressive weed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to end up in a situation where, unless you have quite a high, at the moment, quite a high headstone, you're not going to be able to find graves. Because this thing is just completely taken over. And where the other ladies were talking about where they were visiting, my parents are actually up in near the top wall, which is quite up and it's quite, it's not that old.
Mm-hmm. And it's bad there as well.
My mother's only 4 years in the Inch Grange.
And it's and just as bad there, Dolores, is it?
Yes, it is, yes. And it's and the same there, you go any weekend and the bins are overflown because somebody cannot actually think of having the bins changed on a Friday. But, you know, the majority of people attend graveyards at the weekend. Last Sunday was the Father's Day. I was there and I actually walked down because I live quite close to the Inch Grange and I walked down on Sunday to the Inch Grange with flowers, cooked flowers. And again, I had to manoeuvre trying to get in to the grave. And there was a lot of people and were in total shock of what they were seeing. The graves were the graves were covered in the weeds. The rubbish was all over the place. The bins were all overflown. It was absolutely, I have to say, it was actually very sad and very disrespectful for the people that's actually laid to rest in Dean's Grange.
That's Dolores on the live line with Katie Hannan. And in the morning, Claire Byrne was posing this question. Do Irish people have the same sense of humour as our nearest neighbours?
Both the Irish and the British love Father Ted. But is that where it stops? Do we really share a sense of humour? Well, Jarlath Regan, comedian and the man behind the Irish Man Abroad podcast, is with me on the line, as well as Nuala McKeever, comedy writer and performer. Good morning to you both. Thank you very much, Jarlath and Nuala, for joining us today.
Hey, Claire.
Hi.
Jarlath, I'm going to start with you. I mean, on the basic broad question, in general, do we find the same things funny?
Yeah, I would think so. I think that there are specific things that I've learned since moving here that wouldn't get the same response back home, let's just say. But it's basically the daily run of life that I would think is the big difference, and that humor and mickey taking and sarcasm are so bound up and understood and accepted in your daily interactions back home in Ireland that the big adjustment for me over here was their surprise at the existence of jokes and I guess the word is piss-taking,
yeah,
in conversation. That, like in Ireland, I found that if you ask someone a question about where a shoe store is, they might say to you, I've got a grand pair on my feet here, I'll sell them to you.
Yes, and that is greeted with a quizzical look if you say that to somebody in Oxford.
Yes, exactly. Why would you introduce such a level of confusion to a very simple interaction? Yeah. Whereas in Ireland, we can grow quite tired of it because you're like, okay, great, you had your joke.
Just tell
now
me
can
where
you tell
the shop
me where
is.
The shoe shop is. That's just the daily run of things. I guess stand up is another side.
And then we'll come to stand up in a moment, but TV shows, Neil, I want to talk to you. The ones that transcend nationality. So Father Ted, which I mentioned, more recently Catastrophe, Motherland, written by the Irish, performed by the British. That also works in both places.
Yeah, I mean, Derry Girls,
of course,
huge hit all around the world. Mrs. Brown's Boys, go figure, huge hit everywhere. I think, you know, it struck me after I was thinking about this that the more middle class kind of stuff, I think, has become a bit homogenised around the world. You know, whether you're in the UK, the south of Ireland, the north of Ireland, if you're, you know, your life is probably influenced by much the same things, really. You know, we're all sort of shopping at the same shops and watching the same TV shows. So you have to sort of dig a bit deeper into the past, I suppose, to find the things that make us specifically different. And I think, I don't know what it's going to be like in 30 years' time, but the Irish now who are writing comedy probably still grew up at a time when the church was very big, you know, and there was a sort of a sense that the Irish identity was this one nation. We'll get on to that later. One nation under God, and it was a good old Catholic God, and Mary was on the side, and we all knew where we stood. And all that's kind of gone out the window, so it'll be interesting to me, I must say, to see what comes next. It's also fascinating that Irish sitcoms aren't really done by RTE. I mean, why is that, Claire?
Mm-hmm.
And Claire asked Nuala about the success of the mighty Derry Girls.
Derry Girls, yeah, though, Nuala, which you mentioned there, and of course has been hugely successful. That to me is a mystery because, hilarious as it is, the accent, you have to tune your ear when you're not from Derry to hear what they're saying and to understand what they're saying.
You have to put on subtitles. The second series particularly, the main, you know, the Balti character, Michelle, the first,
yes,
episode of the second series, she came into the house with the main girl, I can't remember her name, and she led off this big stream, and I just sat there going, not a clue. And I know Derry, like, and I end up talking like I'm from Derry when I'm up there, sure. But, no, I had to go. There's a great thing on Channel 4 when you're watching it back. If you click rewind, it'll put up subtitles for that bit.
Okay. So probably needed by many people.
Yeah.
But as you say, it's been a hit all over the world.
Yes, in America. I don't know if it's just the Irish diaspora over there. I was saying, like, it's a bit like in-betweeners and what have you. I think comedy that focuses on that time of one's life, we all remember the hope, the aspiration, the innocence, the cynicism. There's a huge humour, obviously, in that teenage years. But I think, you know, I think you get the heart of a thing from, and it comes from the authenticity of the writer. And obviously, she was able to get it across. You know, there's a political reality to what she's talking about. There's a certain amount of probably guilt as we're all watching it, and sadness. And as I said to whoever I was talking to before this, there's a line in it when Michelle, the same character, they've kind of co-opted this cousin from England that they take the mickey out of him all the time, James, and at the end he's going to leave and he's very sad, and she calls out to him. And I can hardly say the line, it makes me choke every time. She says, no, James, wise up. She says, you're a Derry girl now, James.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it's done with such a light touch, but it's really, I thought that was really profound. You know, basically this generation is saying, I don't care about, I don't care if you're not a girl. I don't care if you're not from Derry. As far as being part of the tribe goes, you're one of us. And that's kind of what the younger generation is, I think. And it's hopeful. And I think maybe that just touches people. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the scene that really struck me was the one, the really famous one, where they're talking about the differences between Catholics and Protestants. And at the start of that, you're going, ooh, I don't know if we should be having this conversation. But it's done in such a way that it ends up being really comfortable and hilarious to watch.
I know. And again, it's kind of, if it's done by somebody from within, they've got the authority to say those things. You know, it's a bit like we can tell Irish jokes if we choose to, but don't you over there tell an Irish joke against us? We can take the mickey. And it was the specifics, you know, that Protestants don't like ABBA and all that sort of thing. I mean, I have lots of friends here and we've all laughed at it, you know, and sort of said, checked with each other. Is that true?
Yeah, and it all was true.
Probably, but it's just taking the mickey. It's a bit of a sad thing. We're taking the mickey out of our prejudices, but I mean, I've been doing that. I was in a group called the Hole in the Wall Gang. They've done sitcom up here, Give My Headpiece. They have been doing that for decades, taking the mickey out of the prejudices that are inside all of us, you know, and saying them out loud.
Jarlath, coming back to stand-up, which you mentioned earlier on, do you find, maybe you did in your early career and not now, you can tell us, do you change things depending on whether you're in front of an Irish audience or a British audience?
Well, it's really interesting. It is really interesting hearing Nuala talk about that, because so much of the understanding and the decisions that you make with stand-up come through time and the realization that actually the more specific you are about your authentic situation, the more general application and resonance that has, that actually Derry Girls speaks to divide, it speaks to class divide. Those are universals. To me, the job of the comic is always to find the similarities between things that are different and the differences between things that are apparently similar. So in the beginning, I think you do come over here a little bit in your own head as to, oh my God, this is so different. It does feel like another planet when you arrive. But slowly but surely, I think you do get to a point of realizing that, no, we have the same things. They're just in different code. The code is different language, different, social constructs, but they're ultimately the same. And when Chris Rock goes on stage and talks about the black experience in America, it resonates with people in Glasgow and London the same way, because we know what that must be like to be the oppressed or to feel on the outside. And to that extent, Claire, the Irish comics that have come here, and myself included, who have done well, have that Crocodile Dundee sense of things. The British and the Irish love hearing people talk about them. In so many ways, when Des Bishop arrived in Ireland and started pointing out to us that the immersion is not universal, it's something that you understand as normal, but it's very bizarre to me.
Jarlath Regan and Nuala McKeever from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, picture this, the lads are in studio with Catherine Thomas.
Today I am coming to you live from Studio 8 in the Radio Centre. Studio 8 is RTÉ's dedicated music studio. I have not been here in what seems like a decade. We have live music today from Picture This, who, it's great to see you lads. Lovely to have you here. How are you doing?
Doing well, how are you?
I'm good, yeah, not a bother. Looking forward to some live music. I know Ray's had a couple of bands in, but you know, we're still kind of getting used to seeing people and hearing live music again. So it's a big week for you guys. The live album is out tomorrow. How are the nerves?
The nerves are at the surface right now because it's so close. Like midnight tonight the album comes out, and we've had this album since like October 2019, so we've been holding on to it for so long, and now it's going out in the world. Scary but very exciting.
So you had it all done and dusted, ready to go, October 2019.
Yeah, we were going to release it in October. It was like 80% of the album that it is now. It's changed slightly since then. But we've been living with it for a long time.
And so how does that work? I mean, you've signed off on it, you're happy with it, but having that length of time to sit with it, are there times and days that come up that you want to change stuff on it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's changed so much. It kind of was finished and it changed completely, and then it went back to kind of what it was.
Yeah.
And we were going to release like a 25-track album at one point, and we just had to like condense it down to 14.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. I had Gavin James on the phone yesterday. We were talking about the gig that's happening, not this weekend, next weekend in Kilmainham. And just the excitement even from him. He said like he'd be nervous. He was going to be bricking it, getting back up on stage and playing to a crowd of people again. I mean, it's something that you dream of. We never thought lockdowns were going to go on as long as they did. So obviously, are you guys the same? Looking forward to getting back up and out in front of the crowds?
Yeah, definitely. I think like I can understand where Gavin's coming from, you know, because you get so used to it and you're doing it so often that it's kind of second nature. But I remember our first gig, how nervous we were together, playing together. So it's kind of going to be a similar thing because it's a new normal, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, look, if we get to play anywhere, I'm sure we'll get over it within a few minutes.
You'll be happy. And I know you've got a load of dates happening in June of next year. Please God, everything going well. You're going to be touring the UK at the end of the year. You've got Killarney coming up in December. So that's pretty exciting. Tell me about the link in between Croke Park and The Late Show with James Corden. That must have been pretty damn special.
Yeah, it was surreal to be back, because it was kind of the first time that we were back playing together as a band, which in itself felt amazing to us because it's like our favorite thing to do. And then having that kind of platform of the James Corden show, there was that added like pressure or specialness to it. And then we felt like it would be kind of like a poignant nod to where we were in the world to do it in like an empty stadium. And it was eerie being in Croke Park with no people in it. But it felt really amazing and special for sure.
Yeah, and opened you guys up to a whole new audience, more streams, everybody kind of knowing your sound, knowing your music. When the news was on there, we were chatting and you were saying that you guys during the various lockdowns were living together and obviously rehearsing and playing and, creating together. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, we all had to sit with ourselves and sit in our own spaces and sit in our own heads for so much of lockdown. And things came up for people. But as musicians, how did that impact you guys creatively?
It was weird because we usually kind of work on the fly. We're very because we're usually on a tour bus or in a hotel room.
Yeah, you're on the go all the time.
Yeah, there's no kind of time to think, which can be a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's the first time we've been in like one place for a long period. And I actually, it made me realize that I prefer doing stuff off the cuff. If I have too much time, I'll kind of ruin it on myself creatively. It's very different, and I can't wait until the world opens back up and speeds back up again so we can get back into that kind of flow. But it did also give us time to for me anyway to go in on myself and sort out like my own head and get to know myself. I've really gotten to know myself in the last year, which I think will feed back into the music now when we come back.
So do you think then, Ryan, that it in a way helped you as an artist or helped you grow as an artist having
that
time?
Yeah, it helped me grow as a person. Okay. For sure, which then kind of feeds into the artistry. So I feel very grateful in one way. That's like the one positive that I've taken out of the whole thing anyway.
Amazing. So you're going to play a track, LA House Party, from the new album.
I went to a party in LA where all of the girls were too pretty for me, and everyone talking had nothing to say. Yeah, and all of the guys were so cliche, wearing Calvin Klein and knockoff rates, posting photos online of people they hate.
Picture this in the afternoon with Catherine Thomas. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.